So welcome to another episode of Stuck at Ohm with John Markov, who's a veteran writer on science and technology. He's one of my heroes and the guy I looked up to when I was a young punk. And if you have not read John, then you missed out on some of the good stuff, especially in the New York Times archives where he still writes, right, John? Am I correct on that?
Well, for the moment, occasionally. Maybe more later in this year, but yeah, I've been writing now and then for the Times.
Yeah, almost three decades, but now and then.
Yeah.
I remember you were the first guy to write about the internet for the, and not like a mainstream publication.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I was a computer writer in New York when people became aware of the internet in like 88, 89. I wrote the first article about the World Wide Web in December 7th, 1993.
Wow. And like no one actually even refers to it as the World Wide Web anymore.
No, that's true.
Yeah. That's true. So how have you been handling this corona crisis as we are going through the pandemic?
Yeah, you know, it's been challenging. I'm in Palo Alto, self-quarantined since we were quarantined. And I was already kind of quarantined. And in the last 3 years, I've been at Stanford, mostly in the special collections room of the Stanford Library, reading Stuart Brand's papers. So I've already sort of, over the last couple of years, narrowed my world compared to where it was before. This has been an odd time. I don't think, you know, this should be the, for someone writing a book, this should be the best of times, right? Because you don't have distractions. But I seem to find innumerable ways to distract myself and avoid focusing and not working. And, you know, this is a very difficult period, and it's been challenging. I get out for an occasional bike ride, but now I don't even ride with friends. That's supposed to be verboten, and although it's a little bit difficult to figure out what the rules are. They're not clear, and they vary county by county. So,
yeah. So before I ask you more about that, what are you writing about? What's the book, and when does it come out?
Well, that's a good question about when it comes out. I am Stuart Brand's biographer. Stuart Brand, of course, created the Whole Earth Catalog in the late 1960s, and since then he's done a variety of things. Most recently he's created something called the Long Now Foundation with Danny Hillis. They built this really quite remarkable clock in the desert in Texas. And now he, with his wife, Ryan Phelan, are engaged in this organization called Revive and Restore, which is they call de-extinction. But I'm interested in it because they've focused on developing and using technologies that make it possible for species that are under pressure because largely of climate change can be more resilient. So coral reefs and other animals that are near extinction, they're trying to make those species more robust. So, you know, it makes an interesting arc because in the first edition of the Whole Earth Catalog, which was kind of a Bible for my generation, Steve Jobs called it Google before Google. It appeared in the fall of 68. And the opening sentence was, "We are as gods and we might as well get good at it." And if you sort of draw the narrative arc all the way to Revive and Restore, Stuart's still trying to do that. And it's controversial, but he's always been a technological optimist. He believes that technologies can improve society. Access to Tools was the subtitle of the Whole Earth Catalog, and that's been a consistent theme of his for his entire career. So that's been my project. Stuart also turned out to be a pack rat. He saved everything, and that's a blessing and a curse. You know, as a biographer, one of the things that I've found is that when you interview people about events that happened a half a century or longer ago, you really can't trust their memories. And so having contemporaneous documents is really valuable. And in Stuart's case, there are a lot of them. So I've been a little bit overwhelmed. And I'm close to having a draft. I've been at this for 3 years, and you know, hopefully if everything went well, the book might be published next year.
Wow. I think, you know, it's an interesting, you know, when you were telling me about Stuart Brand and, you know, his influence on you and Steve Jobs, and, you know, through you and Steve Jobs to people like me. And then obviously, you know, I'm familiar with Stuart's work and you know, and I feel that, you know, it's important to recognize the continuity of knowledge and wisdom, which comes from having a history. And, you know, and all I think about the current pandemic impacting our elders. And it feels like, just like that, if this thing actually ravages humanity, we will lose our history, we will lose our past, we will lose our collective wisdom. You know, and to me, I think that was like the most important thing I've been thinking about, because my parents are older. I've seen a lot of old people, the news of old people dying in Italy. And I just was like, wow, you know, we're about to lose something much more than just, you know, like a data set on like somebody's spreadsheet saying so many people in Italy died, so many people in America died. Like, I just think we're about to lose our past.
That's a very interesting perspective on where we're at. I mean, it's so hard to tell how this will play out. You know, I read all the dark assessments, but you're right. You know, because of who is dying, it's a very different than a war where it was the young men who died. You know, and even in fact, in the Spanish flu, it was largely the young people who died. So, yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but how would the world look afterwards if you wiped out a part of a generation? I don't know. I think it's going to take probably a half a year to figure out with any kind of certainty how this might have an impact on the world. Everybody's speculating, but right now I think it's speculation.
Do you ever think of something like this could happen to us? Like, you've written about science for so long, you've written about technology, obviously, you know, computer technology, but you've also been writing about science and the scientific technologies. Did you ever think that all these things which we would read in science fiction books will actually become a reality, where an unseen virus is threatening our way of life?
I have a couple thoughts. I've certainly watched all the science fiction about pandemics and read, you know, going back to the Andromeda Strain. I guess that's the first book I remember I read. So I've been aware of that. I mean, in a personal sense, my grandfather survived the Spanish flu. And as a matter of fact, if you really think about it, I am a direct artifact of the Spanish flu, because my grandfather met my grandmother, who was a nurse, and she actually helped save his life by giving him sponge baths. And so if my grandfather hadn't survived, I don't think I would be here. So the Spanish flu has always been part of my family lore. Although, I didn't look at it with horror. It was just something you sort of knew about. I think the other thing about sort of thinking about dark futures, dystopian futures, I mean, I did sort of wake up to that at one point, because I grew up on that generation of science fiction called cyberpunk, which all sort of is predicated upon a dystopian post-apocalyptic world. And, you know, I was part of the first group of people who was very optimistic about the internet. And yet I'd sort of come into contact with the idea of the internet first through that dark science fiction, the Blade Runners and the Neuromancers, Blade Runner 2, Neuromancers. I'm trying to think of Stevenson's, the title of Snow Crashes, True Names, all of that literature I understood, and yet I kind of rejected the reality of what they were they were proposing, which was, you know, a dark world. We've sort of skated around that for a long time, and now it's face to face with us in a way we probably didn't imagine. But that's sort of been my general sense about thinking about futures. You know, you have this entire class in Silicon Valley of people I would call futurists, and what I find is they're almost always wrong. You know, the futures that happen tend to surprise us, and they come orthogonally out of nowhere. And I think this is a classic example of that.
Yeah, I think, you know, the thing I've been thinking about is, like, the arc of time is so long, and we tend to think in such narrow increments. And lately, we've been thinking in even more fractional increments. Like, Twitter has reduce us to being like more than just monkeys. We are now like not even able to process anything. But the arc of time, you know, is so long. The Spanish flu cause and effect, you know, it took 100 years to play out, but it did. And I have no idea how this is going to play out. And I was actually talking to somebody the other day about exactly the same thing. It's like, we don't know what will be the impact, but what we do know that this could be preparing us for something bigger than we actually realize. And that something bigger would be the changed climate patterns we are going through right now. You know, what if, you know, in the future, in like not in very distant, let's say in 10 years from now, when we are all forced to live indoors because it's 125, 130 degrees outside. Who's going to be delivering food? It can't just be human beings. It has to be robots or drones and something like that. And while it seems dystopian, but it could be our reality. And it's something we actually have to come to terms with as human beings and figure out what are the ground rules of living with such technology, right? Like we didn't really prepare well enough to live with the internet. Eventually, we made it like, you know, we made the rules as we went along. And then came Facebook and Twitter, and all rules are out of the window right now. So humanity is now working at a whole different scale. And I think I just have been thinking about this from that. Maybe I have too much time. I'm stuck at home. It's like I have a lot more time to think about these things. And I'm just wondering, what if this is a beta test?
Well, the aspect of what you're saying that really resonates with me is it came up in a conversation I was having with Stephen Levy, who's just written a book about Facebook and just published. And, you know, it's a pretty harsh critique of Mark Zuckerberg. But then if you push Stephen makes this argument that net, Facebook has a value for the world by connecting everybody to everybody else. And that, of course, is predicated on the internet, which is, you know, the very architecture of the internet is every point on the net, every node on the net is connected to every other node. And Stephen's argument basically is that's a good thing, that, you know, a more connected world is a better world. And now here we are face to face with the consequence of a more connected world. And I was not having that conversation with him with respect to pandemics, but I was having it in the context of the quality of social life in the face of increasing interconnectedness. And I was pushing back with him. It's not clear to me that net, it actually has been an improvement for humanity. It's incredibly mixed as far as I see, and that there are in some ways, you know, we've had less, we because we spend more time connected via these networks we've created, we have less face-to-face connection. And that's a different kind of society. And in a way, you could argue it's a more isolated society. A virtual connection is not the same as a face-to-face community. And you're right. These networks have come faster than we can prepare for them, and the consequences are starting to emerge in ways that are just totally unpredicted.
I think the other, I mean, I'm always excited by what's coming next. I mean, in a way that, you know, I've been playing Sims and SimCity at home mostly because it's kind of relaxing. mostly, and then I was just laughing at myself. So my entire world is Sims right now. You're a two-dimensional object on my screen right now. Right, that's it. And everyone I'm talking to is just a representation of your real self. Right, it's not. You're a Sim, and I'm looking at that, and it's like, wow, the video game is us, and we are the video game, and like, I don't even know what that means, but what if this is the future? Then how are the kids going to grow up? How are we going to teach them? What, you know, will we have, you know, the number of kids we have right now? You know, what, like, how will relationships survive in that environment where, like, you know, I mean, you know, two people living in a very tiny apartment constantly? What does all that mean? And it's like, there is so much more texture which is required into the future of technology, because it's now like it's not abstract companies becoming more efficient. It's about human beings having to live with this reality. And I think to me that has been an interesting, you know, thread to pull on for. And I don't know what you think about that.
Well, I guess it's, you know, I started as one of those John Perry Barlow optimists about the net. You know, I really subscribed to that notion early on. And by 2012, 2013, I really had come to this different view. Maybe I'm even more pessimistic now. I hate to say it, but I walked away from the best beat in journalism in some ways when I walked away from the computer security beat. Because after 30 years of writing about computer crime and seeing it get worse and worse and worse, I couldn't write one more story about a cybercrime because I'd written the same story too many times. And it was just so daunting and so dark that I decided if I had to write one more story about some testosterone-poisoned teenager with an attitude, I was going to have an aneurysm. And you know, I went off into trying to write about material science and AI and other stuff because, you know, I'd go to these RSA conferences and I'd watch as that business, that industry got larger every year and more successful, and demonstrably the quality of computer security got worse. So I think I've sort of, I backed away from these things. You know, I saw stuff probably a half a decade ago now on 4chan and 8chan that I just couldn't get out of my mind, the images that were so evil that I didn't know how to process what I saw. And recently, just in the last couple of months, the New York Times ran a series on child pornography on the web. And it just broke my heart because it hinted at some sort of fundamental breakdown in society. The scale of which I can't begin to comprehend. So I don't mean to be too dark, but there's stuff going on, like you suggested, that's happening at a rate that I don't think we can process it.
I think, you know, to your earlier point about Facebook and its impact, the negative impact, or the social networks and the negative impact. And to this point, I think these are all the evil and the darkness exist in us already. I think network is probably, you know, it's like a trick mirror, which is doing a really great job of amplifying our evil.
Yeah.
I think that's what it really is to me. It's like, you know, all these behaviors, you know, whether it is child abuse or whether it is hatred of the other, you know, the race, the class war, all those things have always existed. The network just, you know, takes the veneer off reality and exposes the ugly truth. And I think the internet was meant to communicate, not meant to be part of human condition, right? Like it was designed to be a network to send messages and control things, but not control human emotion or humanness. And I think that's the path it has gone down on. And it's been, you know, my view on Facebook has been very consistent. It's like the utility of Facebook is good, like communicating, connecting humans is important. But in the hands of a leader who is essentially intellectually and morally challenged around humanness, that's how I would just leave it at that. I think he, Mark Zuckerberg, is not the person I would trust to connect a billion people. I would connect him. I would trust him to make as much money from advertising from a big, large web company. So I think the there is two different, you know, the internet you and I loved and respected and dreamed about, that has gone into a whole different direction because it's become about the people. And people are like good people, great people, and a lot of ugly people. People, there are thieves in every little community, and there are killers everywhere. And I think we just see more of it more often now on the internet.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So, you know, if I was God and I could redesign the net, I had real misgivings about anonymity. And I would have these discussions with Mark Rotenberg, the guy who was the founder of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. And he has a very 19th century view of speech. And he pushed on me hard about the value of anonymous speech for democracy. But I think that the Werner Vinge view of anonymity that he wrote in that novella, True Names, is really at the heart of a lot of things that are going on. And if I could redesign the net, I would not permit anonymity. I realize that that's problematic from the point of view of surveillance and control. However, we've got all those problems anyway, and we have lots and lots of problems that stem from anonymous behavior. And if you could, if you could enforce the idea of a true name, people would behave in different ways. That was something that Stuart Brand discovered in inventing the well. He actually outlawed anonymity on the well, but he permitted pseudonymous behavior. And it turns out that was problematic. And ultimately, in the early 90s, he walked away from the well feeling it was a design failure because of that. So communities where you are who you are, I think are probably the way to sort of solve many of these virtual world issues.
It'd be interesting to figure out how it all evolves. And I think, you're right about being anonymous is becoming more and more difficult as well, right? Like, I don't think even we have a perception of privacy, a perception of being anonymous, but, four or five data points on our phone and our browsers very quickly triangulate us. So I think it's a little late to kind of be thinking about that. But I mean, in the ledger of your mind, are you still optimistic about technology and science and what it holds for us as a race, as people? Sorry, not as a race, as animals.
Yeah. So the single exception of the period where I was optimistic about the internet, I mean, I'm not a technological optimist, but I am a humanist. So I do think that there are attributes of our species. You know, you talk about the worst of us, you can also talk about the best of us. And so to the extent that you can evolve these societies in that direction around those positive values, I think there's still some hope.
Yeah. Do you find any value in reading news these days?
I do read news. There have been periods over the last 3 years, even in the wake of the 2016 election, where I just basically took Twitter and Facebook off of my phone because I was becoming clinically depressed. So I try these experiments. I'll try to go without reading the net for a while. I'll just read, at this point, I'm still one of the last people who gets a paper New York Times. It comes every day. I've tried, making that my channel of the news. Is that enough? And, there's a time when these feeds that I get just make me feel like I'm watching a train wreck. And so I'm completely torn about that. You know, I try all kinds of experiments of trying to sort of limit the fire hose, and they all fail. And I go back to looking at stuff again.
Yeah. I think the way I think about it is like, I think the younger people are much smarter about dealing with the feed, the information. They're very much good at discerning what's facts and what's not facts, and they make their own decisions. And I think, you know, right or wrong, I don't know, but I think our approach to information is different than the next generation's approach to information will be. I think my biggest concern is, like, we would not have the ability to tell the difference between fact and fiction in the future. And I think it's becoming increasingly propaganda as news and news as propaganda is just like such a fine line. And like, it's becoming more and more blurry right now.
Yeah.
And to me, that is like a thing which, you know, I don't know how the future will look like. I think that's the big challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm in the midst of writing a piece that's going to appear in the next week or two about language models, these neural net-based tools that, like GPT-2 from OpenAI, or a similar one from Microsoft. Google's got one, Facebook's got one. Everybody's developed one. And I've watched the early experimentation. There's been a lot of discussion of misuse. You know, that scenario where your mother will call you and tell you that she's forgotten her bank account number, but it won't be your mother, is now like not even, I mean, that kind of crime is already going on where they're using these generative models to create fake identities. But even deeper than that, I have a sociologist friend who's been experimenting with GPT-2. And the first thing he got it to do was he used an AI to write a ethics statement about artificial intelligence. And it was quite plausible. You know, that's what these things do. And then he thought, well, what else can I do? And he's gotten it to write rap lyrics. He's gotten it to write music. You can pick the style of classical music that you want to write or any kind of music, and you can generate music in that style. So it raises the question of, you know, that line between machine and human creativity. Obviously, these things are not being creative in a human sense. However, they are going to be like autocomplete. The nature of writing will change because you'll have these tools. I mean, we already all use it in our Google Mail, right? It will finish every sentence for you. It drives me nuts because I don't want it to suggest what I'm thinking. But that's going to be seen as a positive feature for a generation of tools, and it'll just sort of push into every other area of what has been creative endeavor. You know, the Allen AI Institute just made this corpus of all of the COVID-19 articles, like 44,000 articles available with this tool that allows you to look for patterns. And, you know, that may actually really speed up the process of scientific discovery. Obviously, those things are good. And then you just have to decide where you're going to draw the line, or if you'll draw the line at all. I don't know how quickly those tools will evolve, but clearly you can see the outlines of something coming.
For me, like, all these tools are going to evolve much faster than we realize. I think, you know, if history is any indication, whether it was, you know, streaming video, online payments, all these things started out in the realm of pornography and then became mainstream, and more things are getting adaptive much faster now. I just feel that the industry, you know, I'm part of and I've written about, like you, is moving much faster. It's like, I was comparing this in my head, like from 2015 to 2020, it's 10 times bigger. The number of people, the number of companies, the amount of money which has gone into the whole ecosystem is just 10x bigger. And so the speed with which things are happening is just going to increase. Even with this pandemic, I think this pandemic is going to reinforce a lot of, you know, behaviors which were not mainstream, they will become mainstream now. Like video streaming and video communication is just, it's normal now. I think it's been normalized. It's way more easier to think about just doing everything on video and not think about it.
Oh, we'll have to see. I mean, we should come back in a year and see whether this is actually a fundamental transformation of the way we communicate on the net, or whether this is an interim fad. It is to be proven to me that this will take over all human interaction.
And the reason, again, I'm not thinking from my point of view or your point of view. So you're like a 5-year-old or a 3-year-old kid. You're growing up listening and talking to Siri and Alexa, and you interact with your iPad or your iPhone, and you do video all day long, right? You know, you do FaceTime or something like that all the time. So by the time you're 20, this is normal. I'm talking like 15 years from now. It's not that far. I mean, I would be retired and everything, but it would be pretty good to kind of have those video calls with my goddaughters. And they already do it. They call me right now, and they're 3 years old, and they pick up the phone, their mom's phone, and they'll just call me on video. And so you're looking at this, and this is like the new normal, the video.
Yeah.
Before we go, I want to ask your opinion on, because the industry's grown 10x and there is a lot more publications out there, what do you think about tech media these days?
Oh my.
Somebody, you know, I was going to ask you that.
Yeah. That's a really, just from a personal point of view, you know, when I came back to San Francisco as the Silicon Valley reporter for the New York Times, initially it was just myself. And then I had a stringer, I guess. And then finally there was a second reporter. And now when I go into the San Francisco Bureau of the New York Times, there are more than 20 people in San Francisco, and all the tech editors have come to San Francisco. So I guess what I would say at a high level, what do I think of the tech media? I think the tech media is vast. And in a very interesting way, I think there's somewhat less technology coverage and more coverage of whatever this media scape that's emerged. I mean, so much of our coverage is of the internet. The internet is, it's not software that's eaten the world. The internet has eaten the world, and that's what we write about. And when I first got to the Times, there were 7 technology reporters, and only 2 of us wrote about computers and communications, and the 5 other reporters covered other kinds of technology. And, I feel that the internet in that sense has perturbed the world in a big way. And that's the way tech media coverage has gone. I'm puzzled. I mean, it's the best of times. It's the worst of times, because there is a vast amount of coverage. And yet I think there are probably fewer reporters who are making a living off of doing this, because there's not a business model to support these things that's actually the subscription models have started to come back, and that's interesting to me, but it doesn't seem like it's a slam dunk either. And advertising-based journalism seems to be very shaky to me at this point. These publications come and go. So I think we may be in for a prolonged period of transition in this kind of journalism that you and I practice.
Well, on that somewhat sad note.
Yes.
I have to say goodbye to you, because I've told my listeners that we're going to keep it to 30 minutes.
That's a good model.
Yeah. And so thank you, John. I want to do this again with you. You know, maybe who knows how long we're stuck at home. And so if you have another fresh idea you want to talk about, where I am on Zoom all the time.
Talk to you soon, Mom. This is really nice.
Great to see you. Thank you for your time.
Sure. Take care.